This is ContraZoom, where we go back and forth about film. I'm your host, Dakota Arsenault. ContraZoom has always been about celebrating film and filmmakers from all parts of the world and from everyone that's contributed to the film language. In the past, we have celebrated cinema from Japan, Asian Americans, the queer community, the black community, women filmmakers, and more. Today, we are continuing our journey by celebrating the works of Filipino cinema. Joining me to guide me on this journey is Paulo Bautista. Paulo is the host of the Oscars Death Race podcast, Box Office Watch, yet another anime podcast, and much, much more. He was last heard on our Better Know a Contributor series back in June. Welcome back, Paulo. How are you?
Hey, Dakota. It hasn't been that long, but glad to be back as always. Thanks for having me on.
Of course. This is really exciting. We've been kind of discussing doing an episode on Filipino cinema for a while now. You had pitched me this a while back. You actually originally had pitched me doing an anime episode, and I think we eventually do want to get to that because it sort of follows up nicely. I did the celebrating Japanese cinema, but it was a two-parter. One was live action and one was animation. And so that was strictly focusing on Japanese animation, and it was very, very high level. And you would kind of pitch this great idea about, like, what are sort of the basic founding blocks that you need to know for anime, not necessarily just from Japan. And I'd love to eventually get to that. But because of that, we ended up talking a bit more, and doing this episode celebrating Filipino cinema kind of fit in more with what we both were wanting to do and talk about. So it's really exciting. So I'd love to know a little bit more about why you want to do an episode celebrating Filipino cinema, and also sort of like your background and history with the culture.
Yeah. So first off, I believe this episode's coming out early October, if I'm not mistaken. So happy Filipino American History Month, actually, everyone. So this is a national recognition in the United States, of course, of celebrating essentially the contributions of Filipinos to, you know, America. But, you know, Filipinos are actually kind of all over the world. Like, if you've been in any hospital or on any cruise line, you know, Filipinos are there. And the reason it's October is actually that's the month when Filipinos first came by the galleon trade from Spain to the U.S. So, you know, Filipinos have been part of, you know, American and North American history for such a long time. One of the films we'll talk about later, this also talks about Filipinos in Canada. So yeah, that's one of the reasons I wanted to pitch this. But, you know, in looking at the films I wanted to look, I saw there was a lot about just Filipino cinema from the Philippines. Now, I consider myself what I call a 1.5 generation Filipino. So I was born here in the States when my dad was doing his residency as a doctor. But I actually spent my earliest memories, you know, once you start developing your memories, were actually spent in Manila after my dad finished his residency for a little bit before, when I was about 8 years old or so, came back to the States. And now I've been here ever since. So I have a little bit of both, you know, living as a foreigner from the Philippines, but then also being born in America. And that's like a really interesting, I think, like, third culture kid perspective. So, you know, on one hand, I'm very much in love with American cinema, but there's always a part of me that always, you know, wants to celebrate my heritage of being Filipino.
Interesting. And so you, I assume, grew up speaking Tagalog at home with your family growing up in Filipino culture?
So since I grew up here in the States, English is my first language. And then when we lived in the Philippines, I actually didn't pick up Tagalog that much because actually, we'll talk a little bit about the history of the Philippines. English is such a common part of the Filipino culture that there are a lot of people in the Philippines, pretty much everyone knows how to speak English, at least in Manila and in the major urban centers. So I didn't actually learn Tagalog until I came back to the States. My dad kind of realized, hey, you didn't pick up Tagalog, I'm going to teach you and your siblings Tagalog, basically. So while I won't say I'm like the most fluent, I do have like a working understanding. And my wife, actually, she's from the Philippines directly. And so she also has kind of helped me keep my Filipino skills a little bit fresher.
Oh, nice. That's good to hear then. Okay, well then I'm sort of curious, did you grow up watching Filipino movies or TV when you were, I guess because you spent time in Manila, you obviously were exposed to it then, but when you were living in America, was that something that, like, Friday family night, movie nights, we watch a Filipino movie, or what was it like for you?
It was more so the music than the movies, actually, right? So, I mean, again, a lot of the popular Filipino cinema kind of nowadays, I wouldn't say it has the best reputation. It's a lot of, you know, if you were to go to Filipino cinema now and you were to go to the box office and look for Filipino films, there are a lot of really campy films, and then also a lot of like B movies or films that are very much kind of like romances. One of a very popular thing in the Philippines is to have love teams, where you have essentially an established actor and established actress who basically appear in every film together, and they're always like the main love couple, right? And so people become a fan of that particular love team, basically. So not only the things my parents were super excited to so me and my kids, me and my siblings growing up, what we did kind of grow up appreciating was kind of like Filipino music from the 70s, which, you know, we would listen to the cassette tapes back before MP3s and all that, of Filipino music in the car, basically. So that's more so my inroads to Filipino cinema. But, you know, kind of now as I've, you know, recently kind of as an adult, I've gone back and started, you know, for example, like I go to Asian American film festivals here in the States, or Asian film festivals. And there was always, if there was a Filipino film in the lineup, I would always go out of my way to try to see at least the Filipino film at the Asian film festivals. And obviously there's a huge history of, I think, Filipino cinema in general that I haven't really explored up until actually I started really doing the research for this podcast.
Interesting. I know also on your shows and even just generally your online presence, you often like to highlight, you know, Filipino contributions to cinema. So I know, like, during the Triangle of Sadness awards run, you were huge into backing Dolly De Leon and you know, supporting her and talking about her a lot. So it's really interesting to sort of seeing how you've been able to kind of connect these two sides of your personality, one, your cultural background, two, your love for cinema, and bring them together and really help to both educate and entertain people.
Yeah, I mean, I just think that, you know, it's filmmaking, I think, in general, I know in like a previous episode, I said filmmaking is a business, but at the same time, right, like on the creative side, filmmaking is very personal, right? And if you can, I feel like films that bring the most authentic self of the filmmakers, be it the actors, the directors, or whoever else, their sensibilities, it makes for a more authentic film, and that you can more easily connect with. Or even if, you know, the central characters of the film are Filipino, if there is an authenticity to it, even if you're not Filipino, you can understand what they're trying to say. And I think that's the hallmark of a great film in general.
Nice. Well, today we are going to be specifically talking about three movies that cover different parts of the Philippines' history and culture. But in order to also sort of set the stage for this, you've actually done a ton of research. You sent me a document that's 9 pages long. And as you were saying before we start recording, you were wanting to add even more to it. We're not going to hit everything that you want to talk about today, but we are going to, you know, preface these movies by what was going on geopolitically at the time in the Philippines, what was kind of going on in Filipino cinema, all this sort of stuff, and how it contextualizes these three movies that we're going to talk about. So I'm just going to shout them out right off the top, and then we're going to get into them more a little bit later. So I apologize, firstly, to you, Paulo, and to any Filipino listeners who might be listening.
If you want to use the English translation, you can do that.
I'm going to do that. It's more the names that I'm worried about. The three movies that we're going to be talking about today is Manila in the Claws of Light from 1975, directed by Lino Bracca. Ma Rosa from 2016, directed by Brillante Mendoza. I hope that's correct. And yep. Islands from 2021, directed by Martin Idrelin. Also hope that is correct.
Yeah, close enough. That's good.
Excellent. Please feel free to correct me anytime I mispronounce a name. I don't like doing that, but it's the Spanish influence on some of the names that kind of tripped me up a little bit there.
Yeah, no worries. And, you know, before we get started, right, I think, one, I want to give a shout out to some people who helped me in my research. Obviously, my wife and my parents, they kind of gave me some guidance on films to look at. My friend Alex Atienza from college, he's been on my podcast a couple of times, and he's also Filipino. We were in the Filipino Association together. He also gave me a lot of good insights. And then a couple of regulars from the Oscars Death Race Discord, Nibori Kiones, Flying Octopus, and some guy named James, they gave me a lot of guidance on films to include on. I'm going to give Dakota a big letterboxed list with, you know, about 100 or so films that kind of, you know, we're not going to talk about all of them in this episode, but I think it would be a good introduction to Filipino film, so to speak. And also, again, I think, like you brought this up, you know, I think film is really good at capturing a moment in history, right? What are the concerns of that particular culture in general? It's partly why I'm really excited about, you know, the representation of Asian Americans in cinema recently, because it kind of is kind of showing how America, right, and Hollywood is becoming more diverse and our culture is becoming more diverse. In the same way, I think the way I framed this episode for Dakota when I gave him the notes is that, you know, these three films kind of highlight just the evolution of the Philippines history in general and a good snapshot and how things evolved. So, you know, I think to start, right, I think a lot of way people describe the history of the Philippines as 300 years in a convent, 50 years in Hollywood, and then 3 years in hell before becoming a country, right? So Philippines was colonized by Spain back in 1521 by Magellan, who attempted to circumnavigate the globe. There's actually a film coming out October 2nd called 1521. For some reason, starring Danny Trejo as Magellan. It doesn't look that good, but I just wanted to say that was really amusing about the timing for that. Philippines was under Spanish rule for about 300 years. Then there was this Philippine Revolution from Spain in 1896. After the Spanish-American War in 1898, the Philippines became a U.S. territory. And there was a brief Philippine-American War where the freedom fighters of the Philippines tried to gain their independence, ultimately failed, and we became a U.S. territory for a while for several years or so. And then at some point, we were supposed to get our independence, but then World War II happened, and we were under Japanese occupation for a number of years. And there are actually some historical films made during this time of Japanese propaganda for Filipinos. That's going to be a kind of recurring theme, a lot of propaganda films in Filipino history. Eventually, the Philippines was established as its own country in 1946. So, you know, cinema came to the Philippines, you know, as early as 1897 when the Spanish were involved. The first film actually produced in the Philippines was one called Dalagang Bukid, or Country Maiden, by Jose Nepo Mukenyo, who's considered the father of Philippine cinema, back in 1919. Unfortunately, most films prior to World War II have been lost. But I just bring up this section right here because this is, you know, a lot of Filipino films, even today, really go into this historical history of the Philippines, right? And, you know, whether it be Jose Rizal by Marilu Diaz Abaya in 1998, who chronicles our national hero Jose Rizal and his story, Henry Luna, which is the 2015 submission to the Oscars by Gerald Tarog, who talks about one of the generals during the Philippine-American War, or even, you know, Mike De Leon, who we'll talk about in a little bit. He did a comedy film in 1980 that's actually a musical that kind of satirizes the lasting effects of imperialism in the Philippines, called Kakaba Kaba Kaba, or Does Your Heart Beat Faster? I know Filipino language can sound a little weird, but those are just a couple of examples. Again, a lot of more will be in the letterboxed. Anyway, post-World War II, you know, the Philippine economy starts to grow. We're known as like a tiger cub economy, kind of one of the growing countries economies in Asia. You know, 1950s, golden age of cinema, right? There was a studio system, four big studios, the first Filipino film to Asian film to show at the Venice Film Festival and Cannes was actually a Filipino film called about Genghis Khan by Manuel Conde that was later remade by Hollywood starring John Wayne. Eventually, in 1960s, there's a bit of more independent films start coming out due to labor disputes. This leads into 1965 when Senate President Ferdinand Marcos becomes president, and you know he kind of was a bit of a populist. He was actually pretty smart. He used films as a form of propaganda in order to kind of raise his profile among the Filipino people and essentially secure the presidency. One of the things he did was he helped establish a board of censors of motion pictures. Now, there's a lot of historical context into why there was opposition to Marcos, Cold War, anti-communist sentiment, and left versus leftist sentiment. But long story short, there was opposition to Marcos, which in his second term in 1972 led to him declaring martial law, which would last until 1981 officially, but he would stay in power until 1986. Now, the Marcos dictatorship is kind of infamous for, you know, numerous reasons. I mean, probably most popular in popular culture, it was his wife, Imelda Marcos. She's probably most well known for having a lot of sues in her closet, but, you know, those sues came from misappropriating government funds. Beyond that, you know, there are multiple human rights abuses during this time period, right? 3,000 known EKJs or extrajudicial killings, 35,000 documented tortures, and 70,000 incarcerations. Many, you know, political opponents, student activists, journalists, religious workers had to flee the Philippines and go overseas to the, many of them here to the U.S., which is partly why there's such a big Filipino-American presence here in the United States. In particular, right, his political opponent, Nino Aquino, was eventually assassinated when he came back to the country to run for some snap elections, ultimately leading to this peaceful people power protest that ended up having Marcos leaving the country. But this ultimately led to, you know, during this time of martial law, this kind of this led to essentially a economic downturn, right? Even though Marcos didn't really want to show this happening, you know, in film, he wanted to show the Philippines to be a beautiful place. You know, there was abject poverty in the Philippines. This kind of leads us nicely to our first film, Manila in the Claws of Light, or in Tagalog, Manila sa mga kukong na liwanag by Lino Broca.
Hey, bata mo. Lumuwas nga ako rito sa Manila, eh. Pati yata kasulok-sulok ko na Maynila, yan narating ko. Inalugog ko ang buong Maynila. Pero, wala si Ligaya.
Yeah, this was an absolutely fascinating movie. I'm going to read the letterbox description of it so people are a bit more familiar with it. A young fisherman from a provincial village arrives in the capital on a quest to track down his girlfriend, who is lured there with the promise of work and hasn't been heard from since. In the meantime, he takes a low-wage job at a construction site and witnesses life on the streets, where death strikes without warning, corruption and exploitation are commonplace, and protests hint at escalating civil unrest. This was this is a huge highlight for me to being able to watch this. I was able to watch it on the Criterion Channel, and it was absolutely stunning. It has a very naturalistic approach to the way the film is shot, where you can tell for the most part a lot of these people in this are not professional actors, which anytime you get a movie like this, which I would think of something like the Italian neorealism movement, where you maybe have the lead actor who's a little bit more experienced, but everyone else is sort of like, oh, hey, we're going to get a construction worker to play a construction worker. We're going to get a prostitute to play a prostitute, sort of thing. So it's people drawing on these real life experiences. And you can really tell that the people in this film knew exactly what kind of movie they were making. And it's one of those movies where you're watching it and you kind of at times feel like you have to watch it between the cracks of the fingers as you're covering your eyes, because you're just like, oh, I just feel like these characters are in danger at every step they go. But it features a absolutely phenomenal performance by an actor named Bembo Roca, who is playing the lead role, Julio, who's this young man who is living in poverty in order to find his girlfriend from his small island village. And it was just absolutely stunning. So I was really glad you recommended this one to me, Paulo. I don't know if you want to kind of give a bit more context to this movie before we dive deeper into it.
Yeah. So, you know, first off, the cinematography you mentioned is by that director I mentioned who did that film about imperialism, Mike De Leon. I mentioned there was a studio system. He's actually descended from one of the founders of one of the big studios. And so he ended up, you know, kind of going out on his own, making his own studio. And this is one of the first films he actually wanted to produce. And it came from an adaptation of a novel that was adapted into a screenplay. It's a really interesting story. Like the screenplay writer went back to school at this Jesuit school, Ateneo, in the Philippines. He was supposed to do this big project, but he finished his semester end project halfway through. So this screenplay was actually kind of like the second project he worked on that semester. But yeah, and then Lino Broca, he actually had previously worked worked on various, you know, melodrama TV shows. Had a couple of failures because of disputes with the studios. Came back eventually, and this is kind of like his attempt at an early attempt at being more socially minded, socially conscious. You can see that, like, near the end, you know, there's a scene where there's like a rally against fascism, against capitalism, right? There's definitely a sense throughout the film of kind of like working class solidarity, right? While this film wasn't specifically targeted by the Marcos administration for censorship, many of Walker's films in the future would be. And part of it was that because, again, I mentioned they wanted the Marcos dictatorship wanted to show, hey, Manila is a beautiful place. Manila is, you know, is a thriving country. And this kind of runs counter to that, right? This counterculture of the 60s and 70s kind of is rampant throughout this film. It shows kind of like the gritty underbelly of it. I've heard people compare it to, say, Taxi Driver, for example. Walker would later go on to actually co-found Concerned Artists of the Philippines, which was an organization to help artists fight against martial law at the time. And then his next film, In Siang, would actually be the first Filipino film about the Philippines shown at Cannes. And then his film after that, Jaguar, would become the first to compete for the Golden Palm, as well as his 1984 film, Bayan Ko, which was, again, one of those censored by Marcos. And actually, this film was actually mentioned by Bong Joon-ho as one of his influences growing up. And also, you know, Dolly De Leon did a feature for Letterboxd about four Filipino films to look for. This is one that she mentioned as well.
Yeah, it was just absolutely stunning. As I already said, I found it was so interesting because this is such a critical film. It focuses on the working class, the lower class, people that are homeless, slums. This sort of covers everything, the corruption of the ruling class. So much interesting things are going on. When Julio, you know, gets a job at this construction site, he's making less than everyone else is making because he's the new guy, and it's a way for him to be exploited. It's either you take less money or you get nothing at all. And then on top of that, when it's payday, the boss is actually writing down that he's paying his workers more than what he's actually giving out. I'm assuming it's to get subsidies from the government or something like that. And so you already have this conflict of the workers versus the ownership class of what's going on. And then as sort of things go on, it just keeps exploring more and more unique ideas of the underbelly of what's going on in the Philippines. It's like, well, yeah, Manila looks like a beautiful city. Look at all these expensive hotels and fancy apartment buildings and restaurants and clubs that they have. But, you know, who are the people who are actually building these places and running them and working in them? And it's all very gritty. The comparison to Taxi Driver, I think, is a very apt comparison. It was so interesting. I think one other thing I want to kind of talk about is I was sort of surprised by the queerness of this movie. While I don't think, you know, it's as politically correct as you'd probably want people to talk about things, I did think it was very interesting that there is an entire subsection when, after Julio gets fired from his construction job, he ends up becoming friends with another young man who lets him live at his apartment, but he's actually a hustler, a male prostitute, however you wish to call it. And he manages a call boy, yes. And he manages to convince Julio to come and work at the club that he works at. And tells him very explicitly what he does, but he's like, hey, we're not going to make you do anything. My boss is going to explain to you what you're going to do. If you don't want to do it, you can leave at any time. You're not trapped here. Nothing is wrong with it. But by the way, none of us are gay. And so it's very interesting that there was like that level of sort of internalized homophobia of like, we're going to sleep with men for money and all this sort of stuff. And not saying that all male sex workers are gay, because that is obviously not true. But I think there is an element of this is not masculine if we admit that we actually are gay. So it was very interesting. The queerness for quite a large section of this movie was so front and present. I was wondering if you kind of know anything about that aspect.
Yeah. So one, I know actually that what we watched on the Criterion version is actually a restored version. And unfortunately, I believe the original cut had a longer section, because that whole segment kind of ends somewhat abruptly in the version we saw. Unfortunately, I believe that the original cut had a longer version of that whole segment. But I think the film actually wasn't able to be restored for that section, unfortunately. But yeah, I mean, there is the Philippines has a very interesting relationship with queerness, right? On one hand, we're 98% Catholic, right? Which, you know, is nominally against, you know, homosexuality, right? On the other hand, right, like if just in day-to-day life, there is a somewhat of a tacit acceptance of the existence of LGBT individuals within the Philippines, right? To the point where there's a whole subculture of like language that kind of influences the rest of culture within the Philippines as well, right? Other films we'll talk about in the future, you know, bring this up as well. Some others I'll mention on the Letterboxd have, you know, very LGBT centric films. One I think of that's very recently is Lingua Franca by Isabel Sandoval, which actually recently came out, I believe, on Netflix, deals with a trans immigrant here in the United States, and that, you know, it's something that's very prevalent throughout Filipino cinema, actually, despite, you know, nominally the country being, you know, not supporting of homosexuality.
Yeah, I was just very surprised to sort of see the frankness of it all displayed on screen. And I'm guessing that Manila and the Claws of Light wasn't exactly a box office hit. It, you know, anytime you have a social commentary movie like this, it's something that is either, you know, a critical darling or a cult favorite or something like that, but it's probably not a huge money maker. So you're able to explore a bit more of maybe subversive ideas or things that go against the general population's thinking. And, you know, you're not going to probably get as much push back as you would if, you know, it was whatever is the highest grossing movie sort of thing, whatever that target audience is.
Yeah, I actually don't know what the box office for this was. I can tell you, right, like at the Filipino version of the Academy, this one actually did win Best Picture, Best Director, Best Screenplay, Best Cinematography, Best Actor, and Best Supporting Actor in 1976. So this was very well received critically. I believe this is actually the only film from the Philippines that appears in the book 1001 Movies You Must See Before You Die. Right. So this is, again, like you said, very critically well received. I mean, this is a film that appears constantly throughout the list of top cinema from the Philippines. My parents knew about it before I even, when I asked them about it, they're like, oh, yeah, we totally know about that film. Right. So this was at least is in the, it's kind of seen as like the de facto portrayal of poverty in the mid 70s at the beginning of the martial law period. So while this doesn't necessarily explicitly call out the martial law period, this does kind of, you know, sow the effects of the poverty on the people at the time. If there is one criticism of the film, it's probably the fact that it is somewhat heavy-handed with a bit of racism against using the stereotypes of Chinese Filipinos within the country. You know, the stereotypes of, you know, Chinese within the Philippines being all rich and kind of unsavory, which is unfortunate, but I think was, you know, again, a product of its time.
Yeah, that was definitely something I noted as well, where we only get a few Chinese Filipino characters in this film, and none of them are portrayed in any sort of positive light. Then again, this movie is like 2 hours long. It explores like 20 different themes. There's only probably so much you can fit into a movie without completely derailing whatever message you're trying to get, even if at times it seems a little heavy-handed or maybe not fully well-rounded. The last thing I kind of say about this is man, this has a gut punch of an ending where this is not the, you're watching this whole movie, you're not expecting it to be an uplifting movie, but you're at least maybe hoping for at least some semblance of a happy ending, and you do not get the happy Hollywood ending in this film.
Yeah, I mean, that's just kind of emblematic of the martial law period at the time, unfortunately. I mean, you know, this is a good segue. You know, again, Lino Bracco, Mike De Leon, this is not the last film they did about the actually, before we move on, one thing I want to mention, you mentioned Bembol Rocco, who's the actor. This is actually his first lead acting role. Actually, they actually had recast him from another more well-known actor because they wanted someone who was a little bit more scrawny, a little bit more unknown at the time. So yeah, I just wanted to mention that since you brought it up. But yeah, like I said, Lino Bracco, Mike De Leon, they went on to do a lot of other films. Insiang, like I mentioned, Mike De Leon had one called Alpha Kappa Omega Bats 81, which is kind of like an allegory using hazing at a fraternity as an allegory for martial law. You know, I mentioned Mariluz Diaz-Abaya, who did Jose Rizal. She did a film called Moral 1982, which is a coming of age film, you know, focused on martial law, specifically from a woman's perspective. Chito Esuonio, from 2002, made a film called Decada 70s, which my cousin actually mentioned as a martial law film that he watched. This was actually the 2003 submission to the Oscars. And then Jun Lana, who's another well-loved director within the Philippines, made a film called Manga Kwentong Barbera, or Barber's Tales, in 2013, set in a small town where a woman takes over her husband's barber shop during martial law. Again, there are probably dozens, if not hundreds, of films about the martial law period, which many of them I will include on the letterbox that I'll send Dakota to include. One last director I really want to mention is Lav Diaz, who is probably one of the most well-known or at least well-recognized directors, at least within the film festival circuit. He's known for having multi-hour-long films, like 4 hours, 6 hour-long films. Probably the most epic of his is a film called Evolution ng Isang Pamilyang Pilipino, or The Evolution of a Filipino Family, from 2004. This is a 10-hour film. That's right, 10 hours filmed over the course of 10 years about the impact of martial law on one family. I haven't seen it, of course, just because that's way too long for now. But I'm pretty sure Dakota is pretty good. I didn't make him watch it for this episode as well.
100%. Just make it a mini series at that point. You don't need to make it a 10-hour movie.
Yeah, I mean, it does have the record for one of the longest films of all time. But yeah, he has multiple films like in the 6-4 hour range, many of them dealing with the martial law period.
Wow, that's incredible. All right, cool. I can't recommend this movie highly enough. If you subscribe to the Criterion channel, definitely check it out. If you like stuff like Taxi Driver or Italian neorealism, it's really got those vibes going there, where it's exploring the underbelly of big cities. Really fantastic stuff. So, Paulo, if you want to kind of lead us towards what our next movie is and what was going on in the Philippines.
Yeah, so... Now, I want to backtrack real quick. So why are these films about martial law important? If you've been following recent events in the Philippines, you'll actually know, for some reason, and this is kind of like where my politics on the Philippines comes out a little bit. For some reason, Ferdinand Marcos Sr.'s son, Ferdinand Marcos Jr., known as Bongbong, he's currently the president of the Philippines right now. And a lot of this can actually be attributed to revisionist history of the Marcos period by pro-Marcos supporters, including the most recent president, Duterte, who we'll talk about more in a second. You know, this is fake news on social media. Textbooks are being printed with revisionist history on martial law. There's like a whole law, I think, movement in Congress right now in the Philippines to like push education books that talk about the economic benefits of martial law. You know, think about how Florida is putting out videos saying, oh, slavery has good sides for the slaves, right? And I mean, you know, this guy, Bongbong, didn't even show up to the presidential debates in the most recent election, and he still won, right? And, you know, part of this is you know, why is this the case? And, you know, there was a bit of a controversy where during Rodrigo Duterte's presidency, he actually reinterred Marcos Sr.'s remains into the Cemetery of Heroes, essentially like the Philippines equivalent of Arlington National Ceremony, which was meant, you know, for heroes, right? And in response to the controversy of, hey, there are all these victims of martial law at this time who suffered, you know, the thousands of people who were killed or tortured or kidnapped, like, this is like an offense to them. Duterte has this quote: whether or not he performed worse or better, there's no study, no movie about it, just the challenges and allegations of the other side. And I think that's where these films could become important. These films become important because they capture that these things did in fact happen, that this history did in fact happen. And despite the best efforts of, you know, of his supporters, this should not and cannot be forgotten, right? And that's why I think these films are really important. So with that, right, we turn then kind of like the history from there. So, you know, after Marcos, you know, we overthrew Marcos, hooray, people power, you know, Cory Aquino became became president. Her son will later become president. There was a movie star who became president, but then became impeached. And then there's a vice president who happens to be the daughter of the president who preceded Marcos. So a lot of political dynasties in the Philippines. And anyway, in 2016, an outsider from this political dynasty comes in named Rodrigo Duterte comes in. And he has a foul mouth. He promises to have a very tough on drugs approach, have a lot of machismo, right? Again, if you follow kind of like world politics at the time, he may have another resemblance to another world leader who rose to power in 2016 or so. Anyway, one of his promises was that in the 6 months after he became president, he would eliminate drugs from the country by killing tens of thousands of criminals in the country. And he has allegedly been linked during his time as mayor of Davao, which is a city in the south of the Philippines. He is allegedly tied to a vigilante death squad responsible for over 1,400 killings as mayor. So, you know, he actually would probably back this up. It took only about 3 hours from him being inaugurated to the first death on the streets of an alleged drug pusher. And then officially over 6,000 drug personalities were killed during his presidency, including 54 children in his first year alone, though some critics say the numbers are as high as 27,000 people killed, or 20,000 people killed, with the UN Human Rights Office has the number at about 8,000 or so. There's a lot of reasons for this, right? The police were compiling a watch list. Like if you were, you know, a watch list of a potential drug user, there was a lot of opportunity for abuse of this for people who were political opponents to end up on these lists. You know, the police had a suit to kill policy versus just trying to arrest them. There are many accounts of police planting evidence on individuals. And, you know, some people see this as an attempt to distract from the domestic issues of poverty, again, that were actually driving the people to drugs as opposed to, you know, focusing on drugs as opposed to the underlying root of poverty, right? And we know how the war on drugs worked out here in the US. So not as surprising this didn't work on there. And kind of further to that, right? Duterte had another certain president who got elected around the same time, a very tense relationship with the media. He suspended the broadcasting license of one of the biggest media networks, ABS-CBN, due to critical coverage of his administration. Rappler, which is an online news site from the Philippines, led by Maria Ressa, who is the 2021 Nobel Peace Prize winner, has had a myriad of illegal harassment and trolls online, and kind of in retaliation for the coverage of the drug wars and fake news campaigns. And by the end of 2020, 19 journalists had been killed and at least 171 cases of journalists being threatened or attacked, according to the Center of Media and Freedom and Responsibility. So now this next film we're going to talk about, Ma Rosa, I actually had submitted it to Dakota to look at because it's kind of known as kind of like a portrayal of poverty in the Philippines, again, like Manila in the Claws of Light, but just, you know, several decades later. We'll talk about the director in a little bit, but Dakota, why don't you tee us up about Ma Rosa?
Para matapos ito, 200,000.
Simple lang yan. 50,000. Kulang pa ng ispang 50,000.
Sure, yeah. Ma Rosa was directed by Brillante Mendoza. And the story is Ma Rosa has four children. She owns a small convenience store in a poor section of Manila where everybody knows her. To make ends meet, Rosa and her husband Nestor resell small amounts of narcotics on the side. One day they get arrested. Rosa's children are ready to do anything to buy their parents' freedom from the corrupt police. So I sort of view this movie as sort of two halves. So the first half of this movie is we're setting up that Rosa and her family are sort of fixtures in their community. It's kind of like an alleyway community where cars aren't really going down that way. They try to get a cab to go to their home and the cab driver won't turn down the alleyway because it's too difficult to navigate through it. And everyone she passes by knows her. They either owe her money or they're asking her if they can buy drugs or she just asks people for help. So very well-connected family in this neighborhood. And they have a small convenience store and they sell ice, otherwise known as methamphetamine. And very, very small amounts. It seems like it's more of a pick-me-up high rather than a full-on, you know, drug users, drug addicts, you know, buying large amounts or sort of thing like that. And they get raided. And both Rosa and Nestor get arrested and brought to the police station. And when they're there, basically the police are like, well, you've got two options here. You have enough drugs on here to go to jail with no bail, and you'll be in jail for a very long time. Who knows when or if you'll ever get out. Or you can pay us money, and you can pay us 100,000 pesos. And which was very interesting, because assuming that the movie took place in real time, that like it came out in 2016, if it took place then, it basically would have worked out to being $1,300 US. So not a huge sum of money, but if you're very poor, that is a lot. So while they're in the police station trying to figure out how they can come up with the money, and maybe they'll flip on someone, so they flip on their drug dealer or stuff like that. And then the second half of the movie is their kids are trying to raise money themselves to pay for the release, the bribe to these police officers. And so they're going around, they're, you know, trying to sell a TV. They're trying to collect money from people that they know, trying to see if they could borrow money from other friends and family. Unfortunately, you know, continuing the theme of Manila and the Claws of Light, of having to turn to prostitution in order to make things meet. One of the sons also does engage in that, where he becomes a call boy for one guy that he knows, an older gentleman, brings him to a hotel where he exchanges sex for money, basically. So yeah, you've got these two very separate sort of portions. One's taking place in the police station, and one is on the streets of Manila, where the kids are kind of racing around to raise the funds to get their parents released and seeing what they could do. But it's not surprising, knowing what I know politically about the Philippines, of, you know, rampant corruption and stuff like that, and especially in the police department, about how organized it all seemed. This is another movie that felt very naturalistic and realistic, like Manila and the Claws of Light, where I could have sworn that this was a documentary that we were watching at times. It felt that realistic, handheld vibe to it. But it was one that I liked the ideas and the concept more than I liked the movie itself. I don't know if you're in the same boat or not, but it's one I liked but didn't love.
Yeah, I think there are elements to it that were, you know, again, it was, so I guess a little bit more about the film. This film actually screened at the Cannes Film Festival in 2016. Actually, it won Best Actress for the mother, Marosa, who's played by Jacqueline Jose. And it was also selected as the Philippine entry for the Oscars that year, though was not, did not make the shortlist or was nominated. But in any case, right? So yeah, I mean, this is kind of continuing a trend of soaring the poverty in the Philippines, you know, to a degree where, you know, a lot of Filipino films kind of get criticized to some degree of being poverty porn to some degree. In fact, there's a film from 2011, The Woman in the Septic Tank, which kind of lampshades this by being about filmmakers who want to get an Oscar film. So they make a film about a woman living in a septic tank, which in itself was the 2011 submission to the Oscars. But anyway, yeah, that's a whole thing. But yeah, I mean, this does have a lot of things. I think it doesn't quite get to the it doesn't quite get to the narrative, I guess, cohesiveness of say other films. But I do agree, like kind of the handheld shaky camera, the minimal use of score to it really helps. And you know, a couple themes here that stand out to me, right? One, obviously, is the fact that, hey, this is a film where that shows kind of like the organized corruption within the police. You know, kind of, again, even though this isn't explicitly about Duterte's regime, this actually precedes his election, right? It was finished before his election, but it's just kind of so, it's right. Like the situation is rife for corruption to happen within the police and within law enforcement, right? Especially how it especially beats down on the poor ones who are not able to afford the bribes and so on. I mean, frankly speaking, in the Philippines, like, bribery is literally everywhere, from traffic cops to much higher up, right? So that tracks very realistically. Another theme I think that's not quite as explicit, but I think is very common without Filipino films, is family, right? People doing things for their family. You get the sense that, you know, Marosa, why is he selling ice? It's because he wants to make ends meet for her family. She has a daughter in college. And then when they're in when they're in jail, right? What do their siblings do? Their siblings go to extreme ends to help their family, right? They have an aunt, a tita, who, you know, Marosa does not want to take money from because there's some beef there. But despite the harsh words that this aunt or the sister has for her, she does end up giving her niece money to help bail out Marosa. And then ultimately, right, a bit of a spoiler, the reason that they were raided was because one of the friends of the brother, his brother, right, so was actually detained by the police and they flipped on Marosa. So again, it's all about Filipinos being very closely tied to their family. I think that's another recurrent theme throughout this film and many other Filipino films as well, the importance of family.
I did really like the performances. They were so naturalistic feeling. So I was not surprised to learn that Jacqueline Jose did win Best Actress at Cannes because she is quite incredible of what she does. I'll say it's sort of interesting because, you know, when Duterte came to power and, you know, we're hearing all these stories about how police now have a license to kill anyone who is suspected of being a drug pusher or drug user. It sort of sets off so many alarm bells where, you know, you think back to the U.S. of something like calling someone a communist in the 1940s and 50s was basically just a death sentence for that person, where it sort of seems similar, where it's like, all you need to do is accuse someone of being a drug pusher or a drug user. And it's like, well, that person has no life anymore. They're going to be ostracized from their community and family. They're going to be targeted and harassed by police and law enforcement, if not worse. And then you're hearing stories about how Duterte personally would push people out of helicopters to kill them and all that sort of stuff. So it was interesting in the fact that watching this, you sort of knew exactly what you were getting into. I was surprised that, other than the fact that the police did assault the drug dealer that they flipped on and brought in, I thought there would be more violence towards these people from the hands of police than there actually was.
Yeah, again, I think that's partly because this was made technically right before Duterte took office. And I think his words kind of inflamed that to some degree. But yeah, I mean, again, this kind of shows the... And I think one other thing you brought up, right? Like, this film doesn't necessarily... it doesn't bedevil or it doesn't demonize the people who do use or sell drugs, right? It kind of accepts that, hey, this is just a part of life. This is just a part of the way they go on about their daily life. And it's kind of this twisted ecosystem within that underbelly of the city of somebody has to turn on someone else, to turn on someone else, to turn on somebody else to feed the police, basically.
Yeah, it seems like it's a nonstop thing because... Ma Rosa and her family were turned in by someone that they know, their brother's best friend, and then they turned on their drug dealer, and I presume that their drug dealer also probably gave up some names too of maybe people he sells to, and it's just going to be this never-ending loop of a way for the police to sort of feed their corruption. And you know, they the first thing they do when they bring them to the police station is they go through their wallet, take out all their cash, and, you know, send this kid that works for them and says, hey, go buy us some chicken and beer. We're here to celebrate now. And it's like, what sort of, you know, public service are the police supposed to do when they're more concerned about just, you know, fattening themselves with some chicken and beer when they're arresting people?
Yeah, and I think, you know, this is an interesting I'll bring this up now. This is kind of interesting. So again, I initially bought this film because in my initial research, this was kind of lauded as like the portrayal of kind of like Duterte period poverty. It turns out actually that Dulyante Mendoza is actually in the pro Duterte camp of all things, right? So I find that interesting, right? Because obviously he actually went on to like direct like the State of the Union or State of the Nation addresses, videos for Duterte. And his take has been like, look, this film shows that drugs are a problem within the Philippines. We need to eradicate them. My take is actually very interesting. It's very interesting how you can take that from the conclusion of this. My conclusion is that, hey, the corruption present here allows for the EKGs and the brutal killings within the Duterte administration to be present. It's kind of like the system, the petri dish that allowed for that kind of whole phenomenon to prosper, right? And, you know, Volante Mendoza has had many, many films. He had he won actually Best Director at the Cannes Film Festival in 2009 for one of his other films, Kinatai. And he's had other films as well. So he's definitely a talented director. Even though he on this particular issue he does end up on the Duterte side, so maybe that might be also why the extrajudicial killings aren't as prevalent here as perhaps in other films that could portray this period.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I found it very fascinating the portrayal of drugs in this movie, because you know obviously Rosa and her family, they're just trying to get by, and you know they're not this nefarious drug lords that are preying on the community. And it seems like she actually cares somewhat about the people that do buy from her as well. And we see that her husband Nestor, when she gets home, he's smoking the meth. And, you know, he's like, oh, it's my birthday tomorrow. Don't be mad at me today. And like, it's not shown of him being this like degenerate loser who's, you know, lost all the family money and all this sort of stuff. It just sort of played very matter of factly. So it's just very interesting that like, you almost can't really tell the politics of this movie. I sort of think of it similar to Clint Eastwood movies where, you know, as a person, his politics are really awful, but his movies sometimes explore some pretty nuanced and interesting subject matter. And I'm guessing this is sort of where like Mendoza with his political leanings sort of bring into it, where he's able to make a very interesting, objective piece of art, even if he doesn't necessarily share the same values or, political leanings as the characters in the film do.
Yeah, for sure. I do want to bring up a couple other films since, you know, after learning about Mendoza, I'm like, well, I can't have a film represent the Duterte period, that is by somebody who is pro Duterte, at least for me personally. So I do want to bring a couple more films. There are a couple of documentaries. I mentioned, Maria Ressa and Rappler, and kind of the whole, harassment of them for being the news that Duterte doesn't like. There's a great documentary. It's actually free on YouTube from PBS called 1,000 Cuts, referencing a quote from her saying that, hey, you know, this is how democracy dies. 1,000 small cuts, before democracy goes away, which kind of in the modern world in a post, 45 era, kind of is a little scary to think about how it's actually happening here again. That's more on the journalism side of things. More, if you want more on the EJKs and the more and the impact of that on the poor, there's a documentary called Aswang from 2019 by Alex Ayn Arumpak. Aswang is a Filipino mythological vampire who kills people in the night. So that's kind of like where that comes in. Eric Mati, who had a film that was submitted for the Oscars recently on the job. He has another film called Bybust from 2018. Jun Lana, who I mentioned before, has a film called Big Night, which is a film about somebody trying to get their name off of one of these red lists, these watch lists of people who might be taken in for drugs. And then I personally saw a film in 2017 called Respeto by Alberto Monteros, which uses hip hop and battle rap as kind of like an allegory for both the Marcos and the Duterte periods of dictatorship.
Nice. Okay. Well, those are excellent suggestions. So I'm glad that there's some alternatives to. I totally understand the idea of us discussing a movie that is made by a pro Duterte person. All right. Well, do you want to sort of link us to where our last film goes?
Yeah. So a couple things, right? So there was a whole section that I wanted to talk about that we didn't have time to watch one of these films for, but I do want to mention it. There were a lot of Filipino films about OFWs or overseas Filipino workers. So going back to Marcos real quick, you know, even before that, right, with the U.S., the Philippines always had a history of exporting labor, right? Be it working in plantations in Hawaii or working on railroads in Canada or the canning industry in Alaska. You know, Filipinos served in the U.S. military during World War II. Notably, you know, the U.S. brought over their American education system to the Philippines. So, again, I mentioned before, in the Philippines, a lot of people learn English. That's because of the American education system relative to other Southeast Asian countries. So during the Marcos regime, right, we were in the Philippines was in a poor economic situation. In order to distract from domestic unemployment issues and to help, you know, consolidate foreign exchange remittances, right, money people send back to the help their families, he formalized the labor code to systematize Filipinos working abroad. And that's continued to this day, right? It's different than immigration where, you know, say somebody moves to Toronto or to Vancouver and they become a Canadian citizen. That's immigration. OFWs are people who retain their Filipino citizenship and they have a working visa overseas as opposed to going to become naturalized. So there are an estimated 2.3 million OFWs, predominantly in the Middle East as construction workers, but also many in East Asia, such as Hong Kong, Singapore, and Taiwan as domestic helpers. But this also includes teachers, nurses, and seamen. In fact, up to a quarter of all merchant marines are Filipino. You know, back in 2022, it was estimated at about $36 billion in foreign exchange remittances were sent back from overseas Filipinos to their families. Obviously, there's a lot of impacts of this, right? Families have to, you know, their parents have to live abroad while the kids maybe stay at home with the grandparents, and the parents are separated for years at a time, not being able to go back and see their family. My wife, for a while before she immigrated here to the U.S., was a OFW in Singapore and Hong Kong, working as an architect. But yeah, there's a lot of films in this genre, right? There's a really good documentary from 2016, Sunday Beauty Queen, by Baby Ruth Villarna, about domestic helpers in Hong Kong, I believe, who spend their one day of the week, you know, Sunday, that they have off from work, participating in beauty pageants. Hannah Espia in 2013 had a film that was the Oscar submission that year called Transit, about a Filipino OFW in Israel who their kids are being forced to send back home. You know, there are some directors like Olivia M. Lamassan, who has multiple films about working overseas. Sana Maulit Muli is actually a film starring Lea Salonga, the voice of Jasmine and Mulan. I'm in 1995. She has a number of films. Lamassan has a number of films of OFWs. And not only Filipino films, but they're actually international films focused on OFWs, right? Recently, Plan 75 from Japan, which showed at the Cannes Film Festival last year, is from Japan and features a Filipino OFW in their world. Iloilo is a film from a Singaporean director based on his real-life experience with his OFW domestic helper from Iloilo in the Philippines. Still Human is a great film that I recommended on my most recent episode with you from Hong Kong about a Filipino OFW worker in Hong Kong. So those are, you know, those are part of the Filipino film canon, I want to say, of OFW films. So, you know, those are some I would recommend checking out as well. Moving then though to immigration, right? Again, I'm Filipino American. I know where you live in Vancouver, there are a lot of Filipino Canadians as well, correct?
Yes, that is also correct.
Yeah. So, you know, in the US, there are 4.2 million Filipinos in the US, which is actually, most people don't know this, the second largest Asian American population in the United States. And then in Canada, about 957,000 Filipinos live in Canada, which is about 2.5% of the population and the fourth largest subgroup of overseas Filipinos worldwide. The third largest behind India and China. I got to shout out Jollibee. If you ever had Jollibee, you know it's life-changing. That's just one of our many exports to the rest of the world. And, you know, you mentioned earlier, Dolly de Leon had a lot of notoriety last year for being the first Filipino actress to be nominated in supporting actress at the Golden Globes in Triangle of Sadness. But she's not the only Filipino in Hollywood, right? Robert Lopez is the 12th EGOT winner and the youngest and fastest. He's the only multi-EGOT winner for his work on Frozen. Ronnie Del Carmen, the screenwriter for Inside Out and Up, Finding Nemo, The Road to El Dorado, he's a Filipino. In fact, in Finding Nemo, when they say they go to Peace Sermon 42 Wallaby Way, Sydney, that was a shout out to Filipino artists in Pixar who would pronounce it Peace Sermon, like fisherman. Darren Criss from Glee, Assassination of Gianni Versace, got an Emmy for that role. In the upcoming film Maestro this coming Oscar season, Matthew Libatique is the cinematographer for Darren Aronofsky, Requiem of a Dream and Black Swan, A Star is Born, The Whale, Iron Man, and again, Maestro coming up. And then the editor for Maestro is Michelle Tesoro, who also edited The Queen's Gambit. Her, you know, won the Oscar for the song for Judas Fight for You. And of course, I mentioned Lea Salonga, and many, many others, right? Dante Bosco, Dave Bautista, Dan Inosanto, who trained Bruce Lee, Haley Steinfeld, right, in Bumblebee, you know, Saweetie, Olivia Rodrigo, Enrique Iglesias, Bruno Mars, so many Filipinos in Hollywood and the entertainment industry, right? And we're just everywhere, right? So, you know, I think that brings us nicely to our last film, which, you know, originally I was actually going to do a Filipino-American film. I was thinking of, you know, a Dante Bosco film like The Debut from 2000 or The Fabulous Filipino Brothers that he made in 2021 with his brothers. But I actually saw this film on a list of Filipino diaspora films, and I saw it from Canada. So given that, Dakota, you are from Canada, I wanted to pay homage to you. And we're going to talk about Islands from 2021.
Lord, parawan niyo na po. Ayoko pong mag-isa.
Yeah, so as you said, came out in 2021. It's about Joshua, a shy Filipino immigrant on the cusp of 50, has lived in the comfort of his parents' home his entire life. With his parents now in old age, he pleads with God for a companion, terrified of being alone after they pass. So it's funny, this is actually going to be the third podcast that this movie has come up on. Originally, when it played at South by Southwest, Rachel reviewed it for the website, and then we talked about it in our South by Southwest episode, and then later the next following year, it was nominated at the Canadian Screen Awards, where it got three nominations, including Best Actor, Best Supporting Actor, and Best First Feature Film. So this is interesting because, like, the description of it doesn't really tell a lot of what's really going on. So you got Joshua, who is the main character. He's turning 50 years old. He works at a, I believe at a university. I'm not totally sure if he's a custodian or if he does something else, but he lives with his parents and takes care of them. Very early on, his mother passes away, and so he's left taking care of his father, whose deteriorating health is very difficult for him to do. He doesn't really know how to cook or doesn't know how to encourage his dad to continue to be active. When his mom was alive, they loved going salsa dancing and things like that. And instead, now his dad just wants to sit on the couch all day watching TV, and Joshua doesn't really know what to do. And so at the funeral for his mother, woman around the same age as Joshua comes over, who was a close family friend named Marisol, and she is working over in the Middle East as a housekeeper, I believe, and she's managed to get some time off, and Joshua is like, hey, you know, if you're wanting to stay in Canada for a little bit longer, how about you come and stay with us? If you want to help me take care of my dad, we'd be super grateful to you. I can pay you and all this sort of stuff. And she's like, no, I can do it for free. I'll do it for free. And so Joshua, who is this very introverted, shy person, slowly starts getting brought out of his shell by Marisol. She teaches him how to cook, how to be a little bit more independent, and starts asking him questions about what he wants in his life, something that I feel like he's never really was asked these questions before. And through all this, he ends up sort of falling in love with her. There's a bit of a caveat, but I'm not going to spoil it right now. It doesn't end up working out for them. But it's all about how Joshua presents himself to the world and how he sort of is coming out of his shell. I really like this movie. It features a fantastic lead performance by Rogelio Balagtas. Once again, I hope I pronounced that correctly, where it just feels so grounded and naturalistic. He doesn't do a ton of acting. It's all very quiet and subtle, but it's all very powerful.
Yeah, I mean, for me, what I really like about this film and, you know, some of the other films I mentioned is that just this feels very authentically Filipino, right? Like if you go to a Filipino person's house, or especially of his parents' generation, a lot of religious iconography on the wall, right? Like the dish that they were making, adobo, like I know how to cook that dish, right? That's something I really enjoy cooking. I mean, the whole idea that there's a plot point about line dancing, like, I don't know, like, you know the September song, Earth, Wind, and Fire from September, like, do you remember the 21st night of mm-hmm. September? Like, that's a whole thing in Filipino culture of just line dancing at weddings and so on. Like, that's highly amusing that was a plot point for me, right? And you know, there was all of the stuff, right? The fact that, you know, his brother has like a mixed family, right? That's pretty common nowadays. And, you know, but they would still go back to, his grandparents or his parents or the kids' grandparents. And, you know, they would make the kids dance for money. Like that's a thing that happens at holiday gatherings with family and so on, right? You know, that surface level stuff made it feel very authentic to me. But again, I think this also ties in. I didn't realize it when I asked Dakota to watch this, but this also ties in very nicely to the OFW section of the films I wanted to discuss, right? Because it mentions, right, like in the film that you know, Joshua, he was a dentist in the Philippines, and now he's working as a janitor. Mm-hmm. Which, you know, again, nothing wrong with being a janitor, but you know, it's kind of striking how people come from overseas. They are professionals in their world, and this isn't specific to Filipinos necessarily, but they immigrate to another country and they have to start over from the bottom. But they do it because they think there's a better life for them there. But it makes you really think, kind of going to the theme of the film, really questioning, what do you want from life? What is your life going to be, right? And also, right, for Marisol, right, the woman who comes over from the Middle East, it doesn't show it on screen, but in the ways he talks about it, how abusive some of the overseas, setups can be, right? Her passport is withheld from her. She's basically a slave, and she's abused or threatened to be abused by her employer, right? That's some of the realities of OFW's working today.
Yeah, I know you kind of talked about how OFWs isn't necessarily one profession or another. I know, like, when the Qatar World Cup was happening a couple of years ago, and there's stories about how OFWs were being used as construction workers, and literally hundreds of them died due to unsafe working conditions. And I know a good chunk of them were Filipino as well. So it's a very common story that sadly we see in a lot of parts of the world, where sometimes you get the different ends of the spectrum of Marisol, who is basically more or less an indentured slave in the home that she works for, versus Joshua, who came as a dentist, but because he would have had to literally go back to school for a whole bunch of years, get completely recertified, start from the bottom, work his way up, join a different practice. Mm-hmm. I don't really know what his backstory was when he was in the Philippines, but we're led to believe that he was a successful dentist, which means he probably owned his own practice, things like that. And here, it just would have been way too much work, which is a huge issue. I know with a whole bunch of people in the medical community, doesn't matter where in the world you sort of come from. If you immigrate to North America, you're not certified. Yeah. You have to redo all of your school and training and residency and all that stuff all over again.
That's what happened with my dad, right? Like my dad, he didn't have to go to medical school again, thankfully, but he had already done his residency in the Philippines. He had to redo it again here in the States. And that's how I was born here in the States, right? So that, you know, I mean, there's a silver lining to that in my situation. But yeah, I mean, that's definitely a tricky situation. One other thing, right? Again, the whole idea of family, right? Like here, he basically gives up his life to some degree to support his family, right? And that's a very common thing. I was reading about the behind the scenes, like the concept of this was usually it's like a maiden aunt, right? Or a tita who, you know, they go unmarried. They don't really have a life. They live to essentially help their parents. Cause there's like this, it's a concept in Filipino called utang sa loob, or kind of like an owing of a debt. Like I have a debt to my parents to take care of them in their own old age, right? Like the question is, why doesn't he move out and live his own life? Well, he probably has some utang sa loob to his parents for the help of taking care of him, right? And he ends up being the one between him and his brother who takes on that debt.
Yeah, it was definitely interesting looking at the dynamic between Joshua and his brother, where it looks like Joshua is quite a few years older than his brother. I'm not too sure. I'm guessing his brother's probably in his like mid to late 30s, whereas Joshua is almost 50. So there's a bit of an age gap there. And it sort of seems that like Joshua was sort of, you know, sucked into living the family life that he has to be there to support his parents, where his younger brother comes along, he was sort of able to do his own thing, and probably, I don't know when they would have moved to Canada, definitely as an adult for Joshua, maybe a bit younger when his brother immigrated, and so he was able to maybe be a bit more Canadian and rebel against his parents in that sense. That was sort of the sense I was getting from his character, even so much as, you know, marrying a white woman and having a mixed family in that regard, where obviously we don't sort of see any real prejudice towards his brother or his wife and their kids, but you definitely assume that there's probably still some sort of separation at times going on. You know, his wife doesn't speak Tagalog, so
yeah. Or the kids are like, I don't, I think at one of the dinner scenes are like, ew, what is this? It's like, don't worry, we'll give you macaroni and cheese later or something like that, right?
Yes, yeah. So there definitely sort of seems to be a bit of a difference in lifestyles as far as the brother sort of adapting more to the North American lifestyle and Joshua sort of sticking to the very traditional Filipino roots.
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, you know, that's that whole idea of being like a third, I mentioned at the beginning, a third culture kid, right? Like in some cases, and this is me growing up, right? In some cases, I felt too Filipino to be American. And in some cases, I'm too American to be Filipino, right? So it's like this weird, awkward ground, which, you know, obviously Josh was a little bit older. He probably identifies a little bit more with the Filipino side of things and not quite as much with the Canadian. But a lot of other films, right, that I have on the list are about these mixed things. Like one I want to shout out is Yellow Rose, which is actually a film about an undocumented Filipina played by Evan Oblizada from the Broadway Hadestown and also starring Lea Salonga from 2019. It's about an undocumented Filipina in Texas, right? And how she wants to become a singer, but her undocumented status is getting in the way of that, which, by the way, those Asian Americans in general are one of the fastest growing undocumented immigrant groups here in the United States, right? So, and the Filipinos being a big part of that is a big part of that, right? So yeah, I mean, there's a whole lot of I don't think that that at least in the United States, the Filipino American film canon is quite as developed as, say, you know, the Filipino canon we've been talking about up until this point. But there definitely is a growing, especially in recent years, a growing idea to pursue to document this idea of being a third culture kid within both Asian American and specifically Filipino American films.
Well, I'm really glad that we ended up doing these three films, because I thought that they all had a very interesting aspect to relate in different social commentaries going on, where there was not really any sort of overlap between what they were discussing. So I felt between these three movies, I got a pretty good picture of the types of issues that concern the Filipino diaspora, both in the Philippines and abroad, and sort of the evolution of filmmaking is very interesting as well. You know, I think the idea of wanting to show realism is very prevalent in these three films. I know you were kind of talking about the types of popular films today, especially don't really share any sort of commonality with the movies that we're talking about. But I like how these three movies, even Islands, despite it being a much more polished movie compared to the other two, had a lot of realism feels to it. You know, there wasn't a lot of overacting. You know, the plot was barely at a sort of a simmer. It was about this guy who just wants to get in a relationship and not just be have his life defined by what his parents are doing. So yeah, overall, I was very impressed with all three of these movies. I really loved it. But yeah, if you have anything else you want to kind of add to the topic of these movies and the history of Filipino cinema, please go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, we mentioned there are a couple of films and directors I want to call that I didn't have a space to fit in. I mean, we mentioned Lino Broca, Lav Diaz, Mike De Leon as directors, Jun Lana, Eric Mati, Chito Esvonio, as some other directors who had other films. Again, their films will be on the Letterboxd list. Some other names I didn't get to mention, Ismael Bernal has a really good film, 1982 Himala, as well as the 1998 film Milagros, which is the Oscar submission for the Philippines that year. And then Gil Portes is another pretty good director as well. Some notable actors and actresses you might want to look out if you're curious. Nora Anor, actually in Manila in the Claws of Light, there's this one actor who wants to be a singer, and he's reading he's singing from a book. On the book is Nora Anor, who's known as the Grand Dame of Philippine cinema. She's been working in the industry for I think over 50 or 60 years at this point. So she has a very long career. Vilma Santos is known as one of the most successful Filipino actresses. She actually now serves in government. John Arcilia is probably one of the most well-known actors. And then some other specific films, right? Birdshot from 2017. I want to shout out. I saw it at the New York Asian Film Fest, directed by Mikhail Red. It's a film that was also the Oscars of Miss, and that was a film about the Philippine Eagle and some poachers. And then I know three films that recently on Letterboxd have been blowing up. Ode to Nothing from 2018 and Cleaners from 2019 showed up on the 2022 mid-year film, the mid-year film report from Letterboxd as two of the outstanding films. And I know last year from Sundance, Leonor Will Never Die, which is a little bit less realistic, a little bit more fantastical. But that was a film that got a lot of praise at Sundance as well. That's one I want to shout out as well. So again, I have a huge Letterboxd list. I'm probably going to add more films to that list than I already have on there. So it's one part a primer for Filipino films to look out for, but also kind of my own personal aspirational journey into Filipino cinema as well.
Well, speaking of Leonor Will Never Die, I know on last week's show, we had Jeff Bulmer. He saw that movie at TIFF last year, I believe, and absolutely floored him and was one of his favorite movies of the festival that he saw. So you'll definitely find a friend with him for Leonor Will Never Die. I think the sort of wrapping it up, do you have any idea of what the sort of future of Filipino cinema looks like? Or, you know, are we going to get like this explosion in great international cinema like we've seen with, you know, Japan or Korea or other places in Asia, which have really shot to the forefront of mainstream cinema?
I think, unfortunately, right, with the situation with Bongbong Marcos being the president right now and kind of like a corruption of the idea of truth in the Philippines, I think, unfortunately, fortunately or unfortunately, depending on the perspective, there's going to be a rise, I think, in films in the next decade or so, because Filipino presidencies serve for 6 years, right? You know, fun fact, Duterte's daughter, Sarah, is the vice president right now, right? So who knows? They may be trying to start a new political dynasty for however many years, right? I suspect there will be, and I hope there will be a resistance against the dictatorship or the growing dictatorship and the corrosion of democracy in the Philippines, both in action on the ground, but also through the cinema, right? In the same way we saw a explosion of films during the Marcos era protesting martial law there, I hope we see filmmakers in the Philippines standing up for the truth and never, especially never letting the injustices of the martial law period go forgotten. You know, there was a film, there was a bit of a showdown actually, I believe last year, where this one film called Katips, short for Katipunan, which was the freedom fighter of the Philippines, went head to head in the box office against a film produced by Marcos's sister, Imi Marcos, who's also a congressperson, you know, called Made in Malacanang, which is supposed to be a more generous perspective on the Marcos in their last days before they had to flee from people power, right? There was a head-to-head. This is not a put-away issue. This is an issue that will continue on. And, you know, I pray the filmmakers will continue on speaking the truth and making sure that the injustices of the past aren't forgotten.
Well, that's all phenomenal stuff. I know you mentioned it several times. I'm going to show it one more time in the show notes. I'm going to have a link to a Letterboxd list for all the movies that Paulo has mentioned, including the three we reviewed, and a whole bunch more that he didn't end up mentioning as well. It's a very thorough and exhaustive list. And so if you're interested in the stuff we're talking about today, definitely check that out. I really hope through all of this that that any other Filipino listeners appreciate what you have put together here today, Paulo, and that I know trying to cover a lot, the entire history of a country is very difficult to do, especially in less than an hour and a half. But I learned a lot today, and I learned a lot from you. So, Paulo, thank you so much for coming on and sharing your backstory, sharing your history, and teaching me and everyone that is listening to this today about the history of Filipino cinema.
Thank you for giving me the chance, Dakota. This is something I'm really excited about. And, you know, who knows? There may be another podcast in my future where I work through that backlog and work through the history of Filipino cinema. So we'll see.
Nice. That's very exciting. All right. Well, then, Paulo, where can people find you? What are you working on these days? All that great stuff.
Yeah. So, as you mentioned, I'm on the Oscars Death Race podcast, still on hiatus, though, with most of the major film festivals done, I actually am planning on recording this week an episode with John from Red Carpet Rosters, going over kind of like who are the front runners in the Oscars race coming up. So if you're planning your fall movie watching schedule, that'll be a good episode for you to check out for what films you can expect. Actually, excitingly, I was actually able to get some tickets for the New York Film Festival, including the U.S. debut of The Boy and the Heron, among some other films, Evil Will Never Die, The Taste of Things, and a couple others. So, you know, those are films I'm going to be watching. And, you know, we'll see, Dakota. I may send you an audio clip or something, or maybe write something up for ContraZoom Pod website, reviewing some of those films for you. So I'm looking forward to that. And then, you know, now with the writer strikes being done, I won't feel as guilty. So I might actually hopefully come back soon with the Box Office Watch podcast, talking about the movies and how much money movies make and why. So, you know, Oscars Death Race podcast, New York Film Festival reviews, and Box Office Watch. Definitely looking forward to that.
Fantastic. Yeah, I'll make sure to link to all of your shows in the show notes, as I always do. And yeah, hopefully we get to see some great New York Film Festival content from you as well. I'm very excited for you getting to see all those great movies. This has been a That Shelf podcast. Visit thatshelf.com for more great film discourse. Follow the show on Instagram, Twitter, and Threads at ContraZoomPod. What are your favorite Filipino films? Send an email to ContraZoomPod@gmail.com. Thank you to Eric and Kevin Smell for the theme music and to Stephanie Pryor for the logo design. If you like to listen to podcasts on YouTube, we do post all episodes there as well. And if you really like the show, consider tipping us on Ko-fi. Thanks for checking us out.